This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to GabFest Read, September edition. I'm John Dickerson. On this GabFest Reads, I talk with Ada Calhoun, a journalist and nonfiction author who set out to finish a biography of her favorite poet, Frank O'Hara. That Calhoun's father, the New Yorker art critic, Peter Sheldahl, started decades ago. Instead, she wrote Almost a Poet, Frank O'Hara, My Father, and Me, which is both an exploration of the O'Hara she finds in taped interviews that her father did, and a reflection on her own fraught history with her celebrated father, and the New York art world she grew up in, and the one she learns about on those tapes. The book is out now from Grove Atlantic Press. Here's our conversation. So, Ada, we're going to start with basic questions. Who was Frank O'Hara?
Frank O'Hara was a beloved mid-century poet. He was very much a part of the scene of painters and poets in downtown New York in 1950s, 1960s.
He was a central part of that scene, but then he also was untimely ripped from this earth. Tell us a little bit about his death.
He died at 40 on Fire Island in a freak accident. He was hit by a dune buggy in the middle of the night. And of course, Fire Island is known for having no cars. So I think his is maybe the only vehicular death recorded over there.
And now tell us who your father is.
His name is Peter Sheldahl. He is the art critic for the New Yorker magazine. And he is has always been a massive Frank O'Hara fan and moved to New York City in part to become as much like Frank O'Hara as possible.
And why were you drawn to him?
To my father or to Frank O'Hara?
Exactly. I was hoping that would work that way. Exactly. So tell those who have not yet read the book. Your father was writing a book about O'Hara. He did not complete it, and you picked up the task. And that's where we start the book, is you picking up your father's task of writing this book. Why do you think your father was drawn to O'Hara?
Well, my father grew up in the Midwest, and he was very creative and really wanted a cosmopolitan life. And he came across O'Hara's poetry in an anthology when he was at a very impressionable age in his early 20s. And Frank O'Hara is so funny, and he's so witty, and there's something so appealing and available and accessible about him, something that really just pulls you in, and also something that makes New York City seem like the most glamorous and magical place on earth. So I think as soon as that happened, my father's path was clear.
There's O'Hara, and then there's the New York City that was around him, the scene that was around him. At one point, your father says that O'Hara and John Ashbery, another famous poet from this era and age, created a lifestyle for him. What does that mean exactly? So it's both about art and also about the lifestyle of the village at that time, yes?
Yeah, so it was prioritizing truth and beauty and art over everything else. And I think especially coming out of the 1950s Midwest, that meant rejecting a sort of conservative sensibility, a traditional sensibility, and not caring, for example, about having a nice house, not caring about being respectable, not caring about making money. And so the downtown scene of New York was full of people who were living in cold water flats, in studios, staying up late, drinking and talking. And they were very happy with that life.
In the book, you write, one reason why I liked the idea of this project was I'd get to think about cocktails and cigarettes, snow falling over Greenwich Village. So there is that scene. How much was that scene one of your imagination? And how much through the process of writing did that scene hold up, or did it get, or did it change as you started to pick up your father's project?
I mean, having grown up in New York City in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I knew that the periods of time in New York City history people are very nostalgic for are often much more complicated, right? Not everybody was friends with Patti Smith. Many people were just being mugged in the park. But I had this idea that maybe the 50s were different. I think because I didn't actually experience 50s and 60s firsthand, I thought, oh yeah, maybe that actually was so exciting and so glamorous that even though I'm sure there's bad parts to it, it would have been really fun. I still think it would have been pretty fun. However, there was a darkness there that I hadn't really anticipated. And in some of the interviews my father did, I just heard this ugliness and this sort of disregard, especially for women, that I hadn't fully counted on.
And we should update people on the process of the book, which is you take over your father's project and there are cassette tapes. For those listening, these were these physical objects you used to put into a tape player. And so you were able to actually listen to your father interviewing these famous poets, artists, and doing his job. You are also a writer. So you're essentially over his shoulder listening and watching him do this. What was that like?
Well, it wasn't unfamiliar to me as a job. I've been a ghostwriter for the past 10 years, and I'm often brought in as a fixer on difficult projects. And so I thought, oh, like I can knock this out. I've done 20 of these, right? My father didn't finish it, but there's a lot of books out there with, you know, celebrity authors that didn't get finished until I showed up. And here we go once again, coming to the rescue. And then there I was with the tapes, listening to them throughout the lockdown, actually. And my father is not like a natural interviewer. He would be the first to admit that. So the material that he was getting, it was frustrating to me because I thought I would have asked that question so differently. Why isn't he waiting to hear the response? He's just jumping in, giving his own opinion. He's not slowing down. He's interrupting stories. And so I became more and more frustrated with him.
And so as you're listening to these tapes, there's one point where you respond, I can't remember who's being interviewed, but at one point you just respond, these people are the worst.
Oh, Grace Hartigan. Yeah. Talking about abandoning her son. And you know, years later, she finds out that he has children and one of them looks like her. And she's like, oh, I would like to meet the granddaughter. Like, what a monster, right? Just terrible, terrible right. people.
Right. And so did that, because part of what this book is about is it's changing trajectory. It feels like it changes a couple of times, one time very dramatically. Did you expect that sense that these people are the worst, or did that cause a kind of darkening of this material you had that you were trying to shape into a book?
It snuck up on me. I thought it was going to be just a love fest. I mean, also, who doesn't love Frank O'Hara? And surely anybody he loved and surrounded himself with would have been the most wonderful, the kindest, the most creative and delightful people to spend time with. And as I spent time listening to these tapes, and I had to like listen to my father as a young man trying to get information out of a lot of people who seemed very guarded. This is even 10 years after Frank O'Hara's death. They were really concerned with their reputations, a lot of them. And they were very eager to tell a specific kind of story. And then he was having trouble getting a better story. The whole thing just started to seem more and more fraught and less glamorous and fun.
What do you think your father was looking for originally when he started the book?
I think it was a great idea that he had. I think he wanted to move into books potentially. He was writing for the Village Voice. He was writing for the New York Times and various other places. It's a hard Scrabble life, right? The freelance art writer. And I think he saw some security in writing books. He had a new baby. I think that was probably part of it. And he wanted to make more people aware of Frank O'Hara and to really cement his legacy in this way. And nobody else had done it yet. And he may be the first.
And why do you think he didn't complete the project?
Well, I went in thinking he didn't complete the project because I thought he had made people mad. He was known for making people mad. He still makes people mad. He makes me mad sometimes. And I thought, you know, of course, right? He offended somebody, and then they took permission away from him, and that sounds about right. Or, you know, he just realized he was in over his head. This wasn't his strong suit. He's a phenomenal critic. He's an incredible thinker. As a stylist, he's just profound. But interviewing people, paying really close attention to what they have to say, organizing things like that, that you need to do for a biography, I could see how he would have not succeeded there.
As you mentioned earlier, and as you write in the book, it seems like as you were listening to him interview, it feels like you're saying, oh, right, I see why he wasn't able to carry this off.
Yeah. And, you know, I always thought he was too hard on himself. He said, oh, I was a really bad interviewer. And I thought, oh, no. I mean, everybody says that, right? And like, you know, I'll listen to them at the tapes and I'll find lots of good material on there because surely these people were eager to talk and you got something. And there were tapes where I listened to them. I was like, oh, no, he didn't get anything from this person.
You have the darkening that takes place as your expectations about this scene and this era confront with the behavior of the people who were in it. And then you also come up upon another obstacle, which is that Frank O'Hara's legacy, his poems, basically the whole bundle, is guarded over by his sister. Is that right? I mean, it's basically...
That's right.
She's the gatekeeper.
She's the executor of the estate. So when he died in 1966, she was young. She was in her 20s. She's now in her 80s. And so for the past 60 years, she has been in charge of who gets permission to quote from his material and what editions of his work come out and anything like that. She acts as his representative on earth.
And so if you're going to write a book about Frank O'Hara, you have to talk to his sister.
Yeah. And I thought, of course she'd want that. I mean, I ghostwritten a million bestsellers, like, you know, this would have been great for everybody, right? Win, win, win. And I just anticipated us, you know, sitting on a porch, drinking iced tea, laughing and laughing. And I was very surprised when that did not happen.
This is also where you had thought your father's book broke down, which is that he ran afoul of her, made her angry, as you just described, made her angry. That's why it fell down. You would know how to get a slalom around the difficulties and the book project would get finished. So that obviously didn't happen. But it interests me because this tees up one of the larger, more fun parts of the book, which is what we leave behind, who gets to define that, and what's the truth of it. So that's a lot. But so to ease our way into that, what is Maureen O'Hara's view of her brother's legacy and how it should be tended in the world after his death?
So, you know, that's a question for her, really. She didn't give me a ton of information about what guides her decision-making, but based on what she's given permission to and what she did say to me while I was working on the book, I gather that she wants his work to speak for itself. And there is, of course, a long history of people saying biography is a bad idea, especially about writers. And I think she's in that camp. I think she thinks that his legacy is fine. And she doesn't particularly want anybody coming along, especially somebody who's not an academic, you know, who's not trained in poetry in any way, which is true of me. So coming along and saying what he means and telling the world that. I think she wants people to come to his work and to make their own decisions.
So she's the gatekeeper to the poems. The door is essentially closed to you. Then you're stuck with a situation. How dark did it get? Did you think when you were denied access to the poems, that's it? It's over. I've fallen the same way my father did? Or what was your thinking?
Yeah, I mean, that was my first thought. Well, was there goes that. And I think I was so shocked. I really I was really sure that she would just love me. She would think I was wonderful and she would love my book and she would think it was so cool. And so it was a real blow when that happened to not be the case in such a dramatic fashion. I thought it was all over. And it took a little while for me to take what she'd said really seriously, which was, you know, she asked some actually great questions when we spoke. And one of the questions was basically, why would you do this? You know, why would you do this? Why would you write about your father? And I really had to answer that question. And once I started actually taking that question seriously and answering it, I wound up with a different book.
Before we go down that road a little bit, your ability to win over Maureen O'Hara is in part, it would seem to me, housed, as you've already said, in your skill as a ghostwriter. That talent, what is required to help people understand this? You say that one of the things that's required is to fall at least half in love with them, meaning the people that you're ghostwriting for. Describe that process a little bit and what's required emotionally as a writer in order to access the voice that you're going to have to write in, which is not exactly your own.
I think it's a little like people describe mediumship or channeling, where you get them in your head, right? You kind of live with them the same way when you're really crushed out on someone. You can take their mannerisms sometimes, or you just think about them all day. And so it's a little bit like being possessed, I would say. It's a little bit like a crush, a little like being possessed, and a little like just being their second set of hands, like, you know, trying to do what they would do if they were obsessed with book structure and had a lot of time.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The future of America is in your hands.
This is not a movie trailer, and it's not a political ad, but it is a call to action. I'm Mila Atmos, and I'm passionate about unlocking the power of everyday citizens. On our podcast, Future Hindsight, we take big ideas about civic life and democracy and turn them into action items for you and me. Every Thursday, we talk to bold activists and civic innovators to help you understand your power and your power to change the status quo. Find us at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Susan Orlean says that a piece of writing should not just surprise the reader, but also the writer. There are actual surprise. I mean, when you get the door closed to O'Hara's poetry, that's a surprise to you, to the reader, to everything. But were there surprises that are out of that category that that happened while you were in this writing process?
Yeah, no, I love that Susan Orlean quote because I think it's really true. And when I write, I usually do it because I haven't figured something out, and it's a way to, you know, especially in reporting, right, or researching and then doing interviews, it's like trying to get information and try to tell a good story. And so there are things that there's the unknown knowns and the known knowns and all that. It's like there are things I expect to find. And in this case, I had a million surprises, both in the research and then also in my life that I wound up incorporating. So as I was working on the book, all hell broke loose with my family. In a way that became kind of front and center toward the end of the book.
So we've quoted Susan Orlean. You just quoted Donald Rumsfeld, Joan Didion. They're always quoted together, those two.
Always.
And Joan Didion said what you just said, which is, I don't know what I know until I write,
right,
or I write to know what I think. Yeah. Did you consciously, so you've talked about you were going to write this book that was going to both complete your brother's work, draw you closer, but also beat him in a sense. But did you, that more intentional, explicit self-discovery, was that a part of your original heading on this book? It clearly is a part of the result of the book, but was it intentional when you started it out?
No, I was planning to continue to be dutiful and to get along with everybody and to make no enemies and to hit all my deadlines and be teacher's pet the way that had worked quite well for me, frankly, up until that moment.
When you were going back to the idea of being a ghostwriter, and there's a point at which your father on one of the tapes says, I'm starting to live with him, talking about O'Hara. Did you start to live with as your father becomes a part of, well, he's always a character in this, but more explicitly become someone you're writing about and thinking about. Did you start to do that? Start to live with him as a subject rather than as your father?
Yeah, I definitely did. And I it's one of those things where he's always been the most difficult relationship in my life, right? He's like always been somebody that I just thought we never quite saw each other. We never quite got along. And we're relatively close. I mean, I was relatively close to both my parents, always, but there was just something missing with him. And I thought, now's the time. This is the moment, that I'm going to fix it. I'm going to really see him and making him a character, making him a subject of the book, I think I thought would help, right? I can see him in a literary way and that will help me see him in a human way.
Are they the same person or are they two different people? The person you knew and the person you've created in your head for the purpose of creating art around it or of creating a piece of writing around it?
I don't think I'd ever really done very much writing about my life while I was living it, like in the actual day-to-day moment of it. And this was a time when a lot of the book comes out of actually what happened that day with him. And what I saw and what we did together and what he said. And so I had the temptation many times to try to live in a way and to try to get him to talk in a way that would be better for the book. I'm upfront about that in the book, I think, where, you know, he got a cancer diagnosis while I was working on the book. And I thought, oh, this is it. This is our moment. Okay. So deathbed scene, go, right? Like, you know, daughter, I have never seen you or whatever. I don't know, whatever. Like I was trying to give him a good death, a good ending, a good final moment. And he just steadfastly refused, right? He just like, he wouldn't do it. So I had to find a different ending.
Did you ever consciously interview yourself? In other words, as any writer, you're interrogating yourself and your ideas as you're writing and you're thinking about something. It's always a process in a way of self-interviewing, but you are also a character in this story. So you're both trying to render it and then also accurately depict and convey your emotions and thoughts. Did you ever actually go that one more intentional step and interview yourself for the purposes of this, the way you would have as a journalist?
Oh, that's funny. No, I don't think I've ever done anything that quite that formal, but I definitely did try at various points when I got certain shocks, one with the permissions, you know, one with my father's health problems, one with, you know, other crises that my family faced. I tried to sort of look at what my motivations were with how I was acting and to try to try to see how things had changed. So for example, when I realized I wasn't going to win by being a good girl, I had to say like, is there any other way to be? And that was a hard question for somebody who had, for 40 years, really only tried the one thing.
At the outset of the book, you talk about doing honor to your father. What did that mean at the beginning? And what does it mean now?
Well, at the beginning, I thought this would save him from what I saw as a sort of shameful episode, right? I thought to have a book like this, to get so far down the road and do all these interviews and not have anything come out of it seemed like an actual tragedy. Like it seemed really bad. And I found these tapes right before a lot of them would have been completely decomposed. Like, a lot of them when I was taping them off and digitizing them, like snapped at the end, right? Like these, they were very, very fragile. So, and the idea that they would have just like rotted in the basement and nobody ever would have heard them or they would have been destroyed. I thought that was so awful. And so I was going to save him from that fate. And that was what it started out being. By the end, I was really trying to redeem him as a human being, as a father. I was trying to see him and appreciate him and spend this time with him and take care of him and to do the book also. And so it became about having a relationship. I'm an only child. And you know, he's now 80, and I thought like, this is our time to get it right. This is our time to like make peace.
And so that you have this personal mission as two human beings. You are also creating a piece of work, which requires artistic choices. And you are also writing about a person who understands that in his bones, because he writes about art and the choices we make. And you're also talking about O'Hara, whose legacy has been walled off to you by his sister, who has a view of what his legacy should be. So there's a lot bouncing around here, which is all connected. And so I wonder when the book takes its turn and you're thinking about your father and conveying him in a way that's true to you, but then in a way is introducing him to people who don't know him. Were you intentional about saying, I've got to put all the complexity in here, all the sadness, all of the times that he hurt you and also behaved in a way that, people who don't even know you would feel angry on your behalf, that creates a more real picture of him? Or was there any tension there with you saying, oh, I'll leave that out because it's too mean or it's too true?
I think I hate books that pull their punches, right? Like if you're going to write a memoir, you know what I mean? Like who wants to read a book about how somebody was so like, they were just great. You know, they were wonderful and so lucky. Like no one wants to read that. And I don't want to write that. So I figured if I was going to do this book, I had to tell the truth. And I also, frankly, did not think he would live to read it because he had a 6-month terminal diagnosis while I was working on the book. And then he has now outlived his diagnosis by more than 2 years. So he's, I think he's maybe, is he 3 years past it now? And so I realized I would have to give it to him. And to his great credit, I gave it to him. And I was really scared that he wouldn't like it because he would think, you know, that it was too honest and too raw. And it did include too many of the times he'd hurt me. And I also sort of thought that he would think I was wrong. And I was really amazed and incredibly grateful that he read it and he said it was all true. He said the book was beautiful. He said it relieved him of this sort of inchoate shame he'd always felt. And I thought that's the greatest compliment I could have.
Not just from a father whose affirmation you write about in the book you wanted, but also as a piece of art. If you pull your punches, you haven't told a real thing, and therefore any lessons anybody gets out of it are shallow.
I think so. I mean, you know these books, right? It's like, what are we doing here, right? Like, who are we trying to protect? And if somebody makes themselves like look so awesome and wonderful and everybody's so awesome and wonderful, it's like, you know, it's not true. And it's so frustrating. I feel betrayed by books like that. And, because I go to books to feel less alone, right? I write to feel less alone. So if we're not having an honest conversation, it makes me mad.
For you, was this a story that had to be told because you're a storyteller? Or did you objectively think this is a story that must be told about your father, about you?
Well, so I thought that I was telling the one story about Frank O'Hara. And then this other story demanded to be told. And I felt like I was forced to tell it. It was one of these experiences, like I didn't actually feel like I was doing a lot of the conscious work of it. And I don't want to sound too like, you know, hooly booly woo woo about it. But I channeled the book. I mean, it really felt like it insisted on being written in that exact moment. And I just did its bidding.
You write about these moments of pain with your father. They are necessary because it offers as an act of writing, you have to offer the whole picture, but they also make this conclusion you come to more hard won and therefore more real when you say your disinterest has been one of the saddest parts of my childhood and the greatest gift of my life. Is that the great conclusion you came to at the end of this? Is that the happy ending you wrung out of this process, which was not the same happy ending you were shooting for at the start?
Yeah, that's the happy ending. That the happy ending was basically, you know, he gave me some things, like, you know, fandom in the New York Mets, and he taught me how to do a score. He taught me how to touch type when I was like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, and like I learned how to type on an IBM Selectric properly. He did that for me. You know, he filled the house with books. Like, you know, there are a lot of things that he did that are great gifts. And then I think even the things he didn't do, the things that were not great, that I wouldn't have chosen, were a gift. I don't know that I have had the life I've had, which I'm extremely grateful for, without his negative example and without his disinterest, because I did work very hard to be interesting, and he didn't notice, but other people did. And I have a great life. So I thank him for that. And also I think it's a happy ending that he liked the book. And I know he liked the book because he wouldn't have said that just because I was his daughter. He said the book is honest. He said the book is a great work of art, and that's what it would have to be for me to like it. And if it had been too friendly, he would have known it wasn't true. And I don't think he would have liked it.
Do honor without lying. Ada, thank you.
Thank you,
this
John.
This was a pleasure. And thanks for the book.
Oh, thank you very much. This was really fun to talk to you.
That's it for this month's edition of GabFest Reads. This episode was produced by Shayna Roth. Ben Richmond is Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. We'll be back next month with David's conversation with Tom Perata on his new book, Tracy Flick Can't Win, a sequel to Election. And of course, we'll be in your feed this Thursday for our regular weekly episode of the Political Gabfest.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.